pay no attention.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. The Great End Oz has spoken.
Who are you?
Oh, I am the great and powerful Wizard of Oz.
You are? I don't believe you.
No, I'm afraid it's true. There's no other wizard except me.
Believe it, there is a two-headed wizard behind the curtain of the U.S. economy. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke and Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson. Are they seizing the moment or dropping the broomstick? When two wizards are better than none, it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, July 16th, and there will be no broomsticks, but the Federal Reserve Chairman and Treasury Secretary do testify again today in Congress on boosting the economy. Also, the Israeli and Hezbollah prisoner swap has begun, an interfaith gathering in Madrid, Spain, leading it, Saudi Arabia's King Abdullah, movie sequels, perhaps not every film should be made, that and all the news. In a major change in American policy, the U.S. is sending one of its top diplomats to meet Iran's chief nuclear negotiator. Under Secretary of State William Burns will attend Saturday's six-party talks in Switzerland aimed at persuading Iran to halt work that could lead to the development of nuclear weapons. The Israeli army says forensics teams have begun tests to identify two bodies turned over by Hezbollah guerrillas in Lebanon today. Once the identities of the soldiers are confirmed, Israel will turn over five Lebanese prisoners. The capture of the two Israeli soldiers in July 2006 sparked a 34-day war with Hezbollah.
The Fed chairman will spend a second day on Capitol Hill today, this time testifying before the House Financial Services Committee. Yesterday, before the Senate Finance Committee, Ben Bernanke told senators the central bank is facing significant challenges as it tries to figure out how to stabilize a shaken U.S. economy.
We're looking at the remainder of the year as being probably positive growth, but certainly not robust growth.
Bernanke also predicted higher inflation and more stress for financial institutions. King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia is in Spain for an international conference to promote dialogue between the world's main religions. About 200 delegates are expected to attend, representing Muslims, Christians, Jews, and Buddhists.
Congress has rejected President Bush's veto of legislation protecting doctors from a 10% cut in their reimbursement rates when treating Medicare patients. The president said he supported rescinding the pay cut but objected to the way the plan would be financed. Baseball's All-Stars took their time saying goodbye to Yankee Stadium in last night's historic game. The American League won 4-3 in the 15th inning, the longest game in All-Star history.
Game.
It was the 12th straight win for the American League.
In politics, John McCain addresses the NAACP this morning. More about that in a moment. Barack Obama heads to Purdue University in Indiana. Oil is holding steady, but down in Asian trading, about $138 a barrel. Dow begins just below 11,000. And this morning, we want to talk about power. Who has it? Ben Bernanke and Hank Paulson, do they have too much power in the U.S. economy? You can register your opinion on that at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And we have something a little more fun as well.
Yeah, we're talking about movie sequels. Are some of the sequels better than the original, or should some of the sequels never have been made? We want to hear your picks at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Sequels just wrong or what?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. Don't you love that man behind the curtain? It's for all you conspiracy theorists
out there.
Many men, many
Wizard of Oz.
Curtains in Washington. And it's just possible that the most important meeting in the U.S. government, or maybe even on planet Earth, takes place nowhere near the White House or Capitol Hill. It's a quiet little breakfast meeting held weekly, and there are just two people at the table, Ben and Hank. The weekly breakfast meeting between Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson and Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke is not an on-the-record photo op for the Beltway paparazzi. It's a private forum for discussions that may just hold the fate of the global economy in the balance. Today, a closer look at the men at the helm, or apparently at the helm, of our foundering economic ship, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke and Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson. Sudeep Reddy covers the Fed for the Wall Street Journal. Sudeep, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, John.
Boy, these two men have an extraordinary amount of power and an extraordinary moment in economic history. Who's driving? Circumstances or these two guys?
They certainly do, and they were probably both each thrown into these circumstances. Ben Bernanke came into this job and probably in what he inherited from his predecessor, Alan Greenspan, probably will turn out to be the worst housing market since the Great Depression. And it, of course, started just when he took over a little over 2 years ago. And so Greenspan really was focused especially on monetary policy, on setting interest rates, and kind of tried to stay out of a lot of other things that the Fed would have done, kind of taking the free market approach. Bernanke, though he certainly was a Republican when he came in and served in the Bush administration, when he came into the Fed, he's almost become an activist in trying to attack some of the problems. As an academic at Princeton, he was the expert on the Great Depression and really understood what happened there when a crash turned into a deeper financial crisis, and what the government response was and how the government failed in that case. And so he's really tried to step forward and be a lot more proactive. You can see that the economy has actually weakened during this entire episode. And so it's obviously a big question of whether that kind of activism is doing enough. But when you consider some of the possibilities, I suppose the counterfactual of what might have happened if he hadn't stepped in such a big way in some of these cases, whether we'd be in a far worse situation than we are now, which is almost frightening.
You know, the economic circumstances you've laid out very, very clearly there, but I'm wondering if there's also sort of political circumstances, or I guess, you know, maybe you just call it sort of power circumstances in Washington that also favor these two men. I mean, President Bush is at the lowest ebb of his popularity. He's in the last months of his second term, a lame duck. The successor is not clear. It seems like these two men, Ben Bernanke and Hank Paulson, have an extraordinary opportunity to take the reins. Is there any sign that they're picking up the power where the White House and other elements of the U.S. government really aren't capable of doing it?
They absolutely are. Secretary Paulson, of course, having been the former Goldman Sachs executive, he came in certainly holding a lot of that free market philosophy as well, and has tried to stay neutral on some of these issues, hoping that the market would take over and work. But he has also become more activist, taking the role that Robert Rubin and Larry Summers did as Treasury Secretaries in the Clinton administration, and really pushing forward and probably guiding the White House along on most of this. The White House certainly hasn't been at the wheel on a lot of these initiatives we've seen most recently. And so but Bernanke had actually been far ahead in that role and had been really becoming close friends and an ally of Barney Frank, the Democrat from Massachusetts, who is certainly one of the most outspoken liberals in Congress. And so they had an especially close relationship in kind of figuring out ways to step in and deal with the housing mess. And certainly Bernanke and Barney Frank have been probably two of the most creative people in trying to figure out plans to deal with this through the government response.
Well, it certainly shows that the power center in Washington is a slippery one right now in these waning months of the Bush administration. As we mentioned, more testimony today from these men. Sudeep Reddy is a Fed reporter from The Wall Street Journal who joined us from Washington. Thank you, Sudeep.
Thank you.
Adora?
John, this morning Israeli forensic specialists are testing the remains of two Israeli soldiers handed over by the Lebanese guerrilla group Hezbollah in a deal negotiated by a UN-appointed mediator. Once the bodies are confirmed, Israel has agreed to then turn over a revered Hezbollah fighter convicted of killing four Israelis. For more, we turn now to BBC correspondent Alim Makbul. Good morning, Alim.
Good morning, Adora.
Now, who are these two soldiers, the remains of which are being tested at this moment?
Well, this is really a process that began 2 years ago. You'll remember then, in the summer of 2006, Hezbollah militants came across the border into northern Israel and carried out an attack on Israeli soldiers. Some were killed, but two were captured. These two, Eldad Regev and Ehud Goldwasser. And since then, what followed was a war that took place over 33 days in which Israel killed over 1,000 people in Lebanon and over 100 Israeli soldiers and three or four dozen civilians were also killed in Israel. But since that came to an end, that war, Israel has been trying to negotiate the release, the return of these two soldiers. And actually, until today, they weren't sure whether these two soldiers would be returned dead or alive. There was no word, no confirmation from Hezbollah whether these two Israeli soldiers had been killed in the initial attack or had been killed subsequently. And actually, the relatives of these soldiers had obviously a very traumatic wait over the last 2 years. And it was only today that they discovered that the two soldiers were in fact killed quite early on, and it was their remains that were returned today. They had no confirmation, and there were very emotional scenes at the Israel-Lebanon border as these two black coffins were returned to the families.
Can you break down this swap deal for us? What is Israel getting besides the remains of these two Israeli soldiers, and what is Hezbollah getting in return?
Well, Israel is just getting these the remains of these two soldiers, of course, very important and have been very high profile in the news here over the last 2 years, but very important for the Israeli army and for the Israeli sort of consciousness to have the remains of these two soldiers back. In return, they are handing over five live prisoners, if you like, Hezbollah prisoners that have been held here, and also the remains of many Hezbollah fighters who have died over the last few years. About 12 bodies have been handed back to Lebanon up until now. But they are still waiting. They say they won't hand back any of the live prisoners until they've carried out DNA tests on the Israeli soldiers, the remains that have been returned, to make sure they really are those two Israeli soldiers that were captured. After that happens, they'll hand back these five Hezbollah prisoners. Among them is one Samir Kantar, who carried out really quite an atrocious attack in the late 70s in which Israeli civilians were killed, including a young child. So it's caused quite a lot of consternation. There's been a lot of debate in Israel. And really, it's a very somber mood here in Israel, because not only are they receiving the remains of these soldiers, they're also handing back these prisoners, including somebody who killed Israeli civilians. Across the border, it's a very, very different mood. In Lebanon, it's a celebratory mood. They are receiving these five prisoners back. And that was the reason Hezbollah carried out their attack in 2006. They wanted the return of Lebanese prisoners. So they're saying that they got what they want. They're saying they see this as a victory. But of course, there were also over 1,000 Lebanese dead in the war, but they still consider it a victory. There will be celebrations in Beirut.
In some sense, this is an acknowledgement by Israel that Hezbollah holds the balance of power in Lebanon. I'm wondering if there is any way that this negotiation becomes a model for possible Israeli dealings with Hamas in Gaza.
Well, the Israeli government have been very keen to say that this was a very tough negotiation for them. It was not direct negotiations with the Lebanese, with Hezbollah. But of course, Hamas, as you rightly say, Hamas are viewing this as something that gives them some kind of hope of what they will get, because of course Palestinian militants in the Gaza Strip also captured a soldier in the summer of 2006, Gilad Shalit. He is still being held. We do know, however, that he is still alive. He has been allowed to send letters to his family. So Hamas today issued a statement to say that they would like similar deals in return.
Similar deals. Alim Makboul, BBC correspondent, thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. Let's just review the bidding for a second. We're talking about Hank Paulson and Ben Bernanke, the Fed chairman and the Treasury secretary. Do they have too much power in the U.S. economy? We want your opinion at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Also, what movie sequels really worked for you and what ones were dogs and shouldn't have been made? I'll talk to you about the two Jakes a little while later in the program. And we're also talking about, you know, sort of the Google century here and Facebook and social networking. What would I find out about you if I Googled you that you wish I wouldn't find out about, that you can't delete, that you are so embarrassed about, it actually probably would disqualify you for running for president? Again, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And when confronted with statements, and I'm sure you've all heard this story, when confronted with statements that he may have used marijuana in his wild college days, Bill Clinton explained it away with that dubious, famous suggestion that he didn't inhale. Now, later on, when Barack Obama was confronted with video records of his pastor making controversial statements, it took weeks and many speeches to clear it from the headlines. But for the future candidates living their wild years right now, what details are being archived in the digital pages of Facebook and MySpace that will become the scandal fodder of the mid-21st century? We've already seen some hints. Eric Kuhn runs a new media consultant business, and he's a senior at Hamilton College in New York. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Does every new media college kid these days have to be a consultant too? I mean, couldn't you just mow lawns during your summer vacation?
No.
The answer to that is no.
Do you see what is going on with this economy? You think we can sit back and go to college? No.
Exactly right.
Absolutely not.
But let's talk about what the issue I raised there. You know, nowadays people have a digital trail of archived personal details that, you know, would make the FBI vetting process wince with the amount of effort that would be required to, you know, figure out what people have done in the past and all the things they have to explain away. How has Facebook and social networking changed the calculus of running for office, do you think, for your generation?
Well, I think it's made the vetting process faster by, you know, by any means. Now it's taking, you know, somebody emailed me and you had Vanessa Williams, who became the first African-American Miss America, and it took 10 months for nude photos to come out. We would have found those like that. You know, Elliot Spitzer has a call girl, and immediately the MySpace photos come out. So it's expedited things a huge amount, which has made it interesting. It's fun, but it also has sort of other side effects where our entire lives, kids' lives, narrate themselves on Facebook, Twitter, MySpace, etc.
And can affect the campaigns of their parents. We've already had some hints of Facebook scandals to come. Why don't you tell us about a couple of them?
Yeah, absolutely. And recently you've had Giuliani's daughter say that maybe she supported Obama and then quickly took that off of her Facebook page when the campaign got word of it. There's been no huge sort of Facebook scandal that's brought down a candidate as of yet, but you see things sort of trickling in, and you see how this is going. John Sweeney, who was a Republican in the New York 20th District, was at a frat party in Union College, and some cell phones went off, clicked some photos of him, and before you knew it, they were all over his district. So that was only, and that was before you could upload photos onto Facebook.
That was before.
That was 2006. Yeah. So, you know, so just the cell phone and the use of these cameras and everything.
And he's no longer in Congress, we should say.
He's no longer in Congress. Right. You could debate whether or not it was because of that. But that's what's happening.
But at a certain point, do we get desensitized to all of this? If there's a little tidbit about every single person, every single potential candidate, every single voter, at some point, do we just come to accept the fact that everyone is not perfect? Shocking news.
The difference is now there are photos. Now there are videos. Now there's substantial evidence to see. Okay, we never saw Barack Obama smoke. Right? You only hear these stories. And now when you see these stories, when you see a candidate passed out on a college floor, I don't think we're going to get desensitized.
You mean like a presidential candidate passed out on a college floor?
Right. We haven't seen that yet.
We haven't seen that yet.
This is the future you're describing.
This is the future. So I do not think that people are going to be desensitized. I think it's going to fuel the fire.
So how do you behave? If you want to run for president, you basically have to decide at age 3... how many cell phone cameras are going to be in the room with you for the rest of your life? Do you have any advice for people with political ambitions?
So someone joked to me that you can get as drunk as you want at any party and do as many things as you want. Just make sure that nobody has a camera in that room, because you know what? You don't even have to put up the photo of yourself. It could be your friend who does it.
Or your enemy.
Your quote unquote friend.
Yeah.
Or enemy.
Or anybody, right? Somebody else puts this photo up. You untag yourself. But the photo's still out there. Who knows? And even if someone takes away their account, it's still questionable what Facebook then does with that. So the photos are there.
So what are the rules to setting up a Facebook page if you don't want to disqualify yourself for future office?
Duck. Don't go to the parties. No. You know, it's difficult, to be honest with you. And as a college student, you know, you're sort of always you go to parties and people now bring cameras and they say, oh, for Facebook, click. Right. So it's very hard now to sort of not be part of that. And so I do think everyone will have these photos. But I don't put yourself in a bad situation. I mean, it's sort of. What else can you do?
That's like, do what your mom told you. I mean, it's also, if you're going to take the Andy Warhol view, it's in the future, everybody will be passed out on the couch for 15 minutes. I guess that's the advice.
We'll have to see. And you see it happening now. It's, with interns, let's say, who was just on Valley Wag, an intern who said he was sick but was caught on Facebook in a Halloween party getting drunk and dressed up. So, I mean, it's starting. And
well, our audience is Googling Eric Kuhn's name. He's a new media consultant and Hamilton College senior, majoring in government, 21 years old, with some advice on how to prepare yourself for political ambitions in the Facebook age. And now, headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thanks, John. 29 minutes past the hour. Lebanon's Hezbollah guerrillas turned two coffins over to Israel. They're believed to contain the bodies of Israeli soldiers captured 2 years ago. In Afghanistan, both U.S. and Afghan troops have pulled out of a remote outpost near the Pakistan border. It was the site of a deadly insurgent attack earlier this week that killed 9 U.S. soldiers. And King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia is in Spain today for an international conference to promote dialogue between the world's main religions. Now, you may remember a couple of weeks ago, the Olympic sailing course in China was clogged up with mushy green algae. There were 600,000 tons of the stuff, and it's been cleaned up. It's been using a brilliant barrier that's out there in the sea, and the BBC's Quentin Somerville explains more.
Out in the sea, about half a mile out, but they've erected a huge boom. It's 13 miles long and it's holding back the algae.
And the algae is in an area known as Qingdao. It's all been cleaned up by 10,000 troops. And so the sailing venue for Beijing Olympics is ready to go.
So what happens? Oh, thanks, Femi.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
The The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, July 16th, and in Spain today, actually any minute now, an unusual religious gathering will be led by Saudi Arabia's King Abdullah. He's called together leaders from the world's major religions, Islam, Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, and Hinduism, not to debate theology, but to begin an unprecedented new dialogue of openness to find points of agreement in confronting humanitarian issues. For more, we turn to Roger Hardy. He is a Middle East analyst for the BBC. And Roger, welcome.
Thanks very much.
Tell us about who's expected to show up at this gathering.
The unusual thing about this affair is that it's the brainchild of the King of Saudi Arabia. You know, the idea of Christians, Muslims, and Jews getting together to find some common ground is not new in today's world. But the idea that the King of a very conservative Muslim country should try and initiate something like this, that's what's new.
And it is actually, there is great irony here. It is a very strict form of Islam, as you say. In fact, in Saudi Arabia, the country, it's banned for anyone to practice any other religion than Islam. What motivated Saudi Arabia's King Abdullah to call together this meeting?
Well, I'm sure Saudi officials would say it's goodwill and reaching out to people of other faiths. I think we have to go back to 9/11 here and the rather awkward fact that most of the 9/11 hijackers were Saudis. Ever since then, Saudi Arabia has been trying to improve its image in different ways. And I think this is a way of saying our brand of Islam, the Wahhabi brand of Islam, has a very bad image. Everybody sees us as intolerant and so on. And they're trying to present a kinder face to the outside world.
Do you think it was at all triggered perhaps by King Abdullah's meeting with Pope Benedict at the Vatican last year? Was that a turning point?
Yes, I think that's what started it. And the king's a very cautious man, as Saudi rulers tend to be, so he's tried to prepare the way for this. You're right that the visit to the Vatican last year was a kind of signal of intent. But then the king hosted a big gathering of Muslim leaders and Muslim clerics in Saudi Arabia to kind of give a green light to this issue. We have to remember that some of the more conservative elements in Saudi Arabia really are not comfortable with this. For them, the only true faith is the Wahhabi form of Islam. They're really not wowed by pluralism and dialogue with other faiths.
Well, Roger, that begs the question then, what is the sort of controversial line that King Abdullah has to walk here? Because at least in the photograph, it appears as though he's speaking for all Muslims. And for a Saudi leader to do that, being from the Wahhabist sect of Islam, that's a pretty dicey proposition.
You're right. He has to be very careful. He has to kind of look over his shoulder all the time to try and see how this will play back home. It's interesting that such a thing really was only possible, you know, in faraway Spain. Saudi Arabia is nowhere near ready to host this kind of thing on Saudi soil.
Spain, the former Muslim country, we should point out.
Sure. And the fact that it has a monarchy like Saudi Arabia is good. The fact that the Saudis have good relations with Spain is good. I think the real test of this down the line, and this could be, frankly, several years down the line, is, you know, Christians who take part in such dialogues with the Saudis will say, well, when will you be ready to allow a church to be built on Saudi soil? When will you really clean up your school books and remove highly offensive references to Christians, Jews, and even other kinds of Muslims, you know, Shiite Muslims and Sufi Muslims? The Saudis, I think, are trying to signal, well, we're starting that process. But most people would say they have a very, very long way to go.
But Roger, clearly some world religious leaders are taking this seriously. I've read that the Secretary General of the World Jewish Congress will be there, as well as Catholic Cardinal Jean-Louis Turan, as well as another roughly 200 or so members, prominent members of the religious world community.
Sure. And I think they want to test Saudi intentions here. They want to see how far Saudi Arabia is going to go. Interestingly, too, there are at least some Saudi liberals, the kind of Western-educated liberals in Saudi Arabia, who are hoping that this also signals the start, the slow start of change within that country. I think, though, you have to be pretty optimistic to think that a king, especially a king who's in his 80s, is going to really have the time and the opportunity and the steel, if you like, to push ahead with a process that's easier to do maybe in the outside world, but very difficult to do in this conservative Saudi kingdom itself.
Roger Hardy, thanks for joining us. Roger Hardy is the BBC or a BBC Middle East analyst. And now we're going to get some headlines from Femi Okay. Femi?
Hello there, Dora. 22 minutes to the hour. Firefighters in California are using controlled burns in a Los Padres National Forest in the hopes of containing a huge wildfire still burning through the area. U.S. troops have pulled out of a remote base where militants killed 9 Americans earlier on this week. Afghan officials are saying that insurgents have now moved into the area. Charles Manson devotee Susan Atkins is dying of brain cancer in a California prison, but she still won't be released. And now to one of the stories that we're following in quite a lot of detail in our newsroom. A U.S. diplomat heads to Iran for nuclear talks, and that's happening this weekend. The diplomat is William Burns. He's the U.S.'s third highest-ranking diplomat, and he will attend the talks in Switzerland this weekend. Now, the aims of the talks, there's 6 countries involved within those talks, and the aims of the talks to persuade Iran to halt development of atomic weapons. Iran's envoy is Saeed Jalili, and there will be no direct negotiations with the U.S., and Iran, no private meetings at all. But a U.S. official said off the record, and I quote, "This is a one-time event. We will be there to listen, not negotiate," end of quote. And the official contact between Iran and the U.S. is very, very rare. So this is quite a historical meeting happening this weekend. It'll be interesting to see what comes out of that.
This is the latest in a series of details, though, out of the Bush administration that suggests something is going on with U.S.-Iran policy, that's for sure.
Absolutely. There's a lot of momentum taking place over the last couple of weeks, that's for sure. As we move on to a story that I touched upon in the last newscast that Adora had questions for, it was about the algae in an area known as Qingdao in China.
Can we agree to call them algae?
Algae, sorry.
That's all right. It's okay.
Shall I say domino? Still working on that.
All right, let's hear about the algae.
Yeah, okay, the algae. This is in an area known as Qingdao. It's the main Olympic sailing venue in China. Now, they were horrified in China to find that the whole area had been covered with this green, mushy slime. There was 600,000 tons of it. The army went out. They turned out, 10,000 troops turned out, and by hand they filled yellow bags.
By hand?
Yes, by hand, but there were 10,000 troops. By hand, they filled the bags full of the algae and then moved it out of the way. And to stop more algae coming in, they erected a barrier, basically a boom, that's 13 miles long. So we should be safe as far as the Olympic sailing event is concerned.
Labor, not a problem.
So after all of that explanation, did you have another question, Adora?
No, that sums it up. Thanks
and
so much.
Adorable sailing outfits won't be smudged with algae. Thank you.
You're welcome. Algae.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
It's The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji.
You know, it's a rule in Hollywood, Adora.
Which is?
Do not leave well enough alone. No. If a movie is successful, what does it need?
A sequel.
And we're going to be examining the issue of sequels in this little segment here, like these, for instance.
From the geniuses who took you to White Castle.
This ain't gonna be easy.
Not as easy as it used to be.
The soldier without a country. You know his name.
People are dying. What would you have me do?
Endure.
It's all part of the plan.
Those are this year's installments in the parade of sequels out of Hollywood. They are from Rambo, Indiana Jones, Harold and Kumar, Hellboy 2, The Golden Army, and the new Batman movie, The Dark Knight.
I want to see that one.
Yeah, that's going to be great.
The first one was good.
It's actually the sixth Batman movie, but the second from this director. So it is kind of a sequel, and it's getting raves. But the bar, the high bar for sequels is certainly this movie from 1974. I think you know what it is, Adora.
Is it true that in the year 1950, you devised the murder of the heads of the so-called five families in New York?
It's a complete falsehood.
The Godfather Part 2 is the final chapter in the violent history of the Corleone crime family.
Of course, it wasn't the final chapter, but Godfather 2, which was made after Godfather 1, was pretty successful by Francis Ford Coppola. It won Best Picture in 1974, and no sequel has ever done that. But a lot of sequels become Part 3, and they turn out like this. Kind of cheesy. Godfather 3.
Didn't do so well.
Did not
it was
so well.
Universally panned. And it came roughly,
well,
what was that, 20?
And then she died.
Kind of like the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was not, well, it was really panned, and the Godfather enthusiasts absolutely hated it. But it sort of raises the issue of the 2-3 rule. There are a lot of sequels that are great, number two, but number three sort of dies. Here's an example of the 2-3 rule.
You're not a Terminator anymore, all right? You got that? You just can't go around killing people.
Why?
What do you mean, why? Because you can't.
Why?
Because you just can't, okay? Trust me on this.
Can't go around killing people. Trust me on this. Terminator 2 was a fantastic movie. It was a great sequel, and it did incredibly well at the box office. But T3,
Didn't do so well.
Kind of a dog. There's another example of 2-3 there that I'll think of in a minute. But, of course, a lot of sequels make it to 3.
2-3? That's actually an example of the rule turned on its head upside down.
And that's kind of a trilogy, so it's not really a sequel. But certainly Jackson did a fabulous job with Lord of the Rings and took home Best Picture for his number 3. But sequels that don't quite work at all. The Two Jakes, which was a sequel to Chinatown. Dreadful movie. Here's some other dogs.
From the very beginning of Dumb and Dumber. Dumb and Dumber-er.
Now she's taking her fight to the nation's capital. Legally Blonde 2. Red, White, and Blonde. Blues are back.
Yay! I'm getting the band back together.
From Dumb and Dumber-er, Legally Blonde 2, Red, White, and Blonde, and the Blues Brothers 2000. Some great sequels that work well. Toy Story 2, right?
Yes, yeah,
Aliens,
Shrek 2.
A sequel. Shrek 2.
Born Supremacy or Ultimatum.
What are your favorite sequels? 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Time now for the latest headlines from Femi Oke. Femi?
Hello there, Adora. Coming up to 12 minutes to the hour, the Senate has overturned a presidential veto that would have cut Medicare payments to doctors by 10%. John McCain will give a speech at the NAACP annual convention this morning. This afternoon, Barack Obama will be in Indiana, where he's holding a summit on confronting 21st century threats. New legislation may end a two-decade-old ban that prevents people who are HIV positive from visiting or emigrating to the United States. And in Israel, we're going through a very convoluted process where Israel and Hezbollah are exchanging prisoners. Also includes two bodies being handed over by Hezbollah today. The BBC's Alan Magbor explained the process.
They say they won't hand back any of the live prisoners until they've carried out DNA tests on the Israeli soldiers, the remains that have been returned, to make sure they really are those two Israeli soldiers that were captured. After that happens, they'll hand back these five Hezbollah prisoners.
That was the BBC's Alan Magbul talking to us earlier on The Takeaway. And just one final note, if you're flying, the next time you pick up your ticket, you may well see an advert on your ticket stub. It's the latest way that the airlines are coming up with to make some money and to offset some of those really high fuel charges.
Some of the planes will actually be carrying banners. They'll be pulling them behind the plane as it travels
across
the
country.
Yes, actually, that's not happening, but thankfully, you give us real news, Femi. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
In just a few hours, as Femi pointed out there, Republican presidential hopeful John McCain will be speaking at the 99th annual NAACP conference. The numbers don't lie, though. Whether you're looking at the primary results or recent polls, black voters in key swing states overwhelmingly support Barack Obama. So what is the mission for John McCain in Cincinnati today? Joining us now is Chicago Tribune columnist and good friend Clarence Page. Clarence, good morning.
Good morning, John.
It's great to talk to you.
You too. Been a long time.
Yes, indeed it has. But this is an interesting subject. I mean, uphill battle is, a generous way of describing the mission for John McCain. Is this a photo op, or can he actually convince people?
Well, you have to be a little Machiavellian, John, and our experience covering Chicago politics is very instructive here. The fact is that McCain doesn't expect to make a big dent in among black voters. This is such a special year, a really historical event, a lot like when we were covering Harold Washington back in Chicago in the 80s, that he doesn't expect to make a big dent. I think he'll be lucky to get the regular 10% that Republican candidates usually get from black voters. But he wants to reach moderate swing voters overall who might be inclined toward voting for him but be concerned that he might be as polarizing as President Bush turned out to be among black voters. Although I got to give Bush his props. In 2004, he actually expanded his black voter turnout from 2000 from about 11% to as high as 14% in some places, like Ohio, which is where the NAACP convention is being held. So I think McCain really wants to reach Ohio voters, that very important state, as well as around the rest of the country.
And that's actually ironic, because there was that dust-up when President Bush refused to go speak before the NAACP during his campaigning time, which brings me to a question about, is this a political calculation, Clarence? In other words, does John McCain need to speak in front of the NAACP knowing he's not likely to pick up much support because he would not want to deal with the fallout from not attending?
I think that's true. President Bush did attend the NAACP when he was candidate Bush, but then once he became president, never came back. And that was also after Julian Bond, the NAACP chairman, referred to the Taliban wing of the Republican Party in a speech back then. And also there were the James Byrd TV ads, which back in 2000 tried to link Bush to a civil rights bill that he did not sign in Texas that actually had to do with gay rights. The ad didn't mention that, but it had James Byrd's widow. This is a black woman who was killed a black man was killed in a racist attack in Texas. Those ads made it sound like Bush supported the killing of that black man, when he actually was a governor when their killers were found and convicted. Things like that resulted in Bush not ever going back to the NAACP, and that resulted in bad relations that I think John McCain wants to avoid.
Well, I think John McCain, could say it would be successful if he were to hold on to the Bush 2004 gains, but with the phenomenon of Barack Obama, that doesn't seem likely. It's an interesting year for ethnic politics, that's for sure. Clarence Page, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Clarence Page, a columnist for the Chicago Tribune, speaking to us from Baltimore. Baltimore, Maryland.
And now, John, we're going to talk about Iran. A high-ranking U.S. diplomat will attend talks with Iran's chief nuclear negotiator this weekend in Switzerland. The U.S. says there won't be a private meeting between the two, nor will there be any negotiations on the nuclear issue. But clearly, a significant shift in U.S. policy. In the past, the Bush administration has refused to hold talks with Iran until it suspends its uranium enrichment program. And there's certainly been a lot of rhetoric in the past weeks. John Lyne, BBC World Service reporter, joins us now. John, what do you make of this?
Well, I think it's very interesting indeed, because there's been a lot of signs here in Tehran that the government here is thinking of a major change of policy for itself. President Ahmadinejad the other day, for example, said that he was open to direct talks with the United States, and he also welcomed a suggestion that's been made in Washington for a U.S. interest section here, basically a U.S. diplomatic presence here, the first time since the revolution. So some great opportunities here. Also an advisor to the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei, a very senior official, said he was very interested in the latest diplomatic initiative, which was brought to Tehran by the EU envoy, Javier Solana. So they're putting feelers out from here, and they seem to have been heard by somebody in Washington, and I think they will very much welcome this this idea that William Burns, Bill Burns, a senior State Department official, will be allowed to join the talks in Geneva. Mm-hmm. It says from America that Washington means business, and it also means that there's more weight to the negotiations, that Washington is fully behind the negotiations currently being conducted by Mr. Solana.
And John, but this is all happening at the same time. Last week, Iran was testing missiles, claiming that they had a missile that could hit Israel, which was, of course, shorter ranker, the U.S., which came back and suggested that perhaps Iran should stop that kind of testing. And this is just one of several events in the past weeks that have seemed to indicate a ratcheting up of the rhetoric. Was all of that to get to this end?
Well, who knows? Sometimes in diplomacy, things mean the opposite of what they first appear. I mean, that missile test, which looked like a very strong warning from Iran, saying we're ready to attack you, may have actually meant we're ready to talk, but we want to have a bit of a show of force first. Or it could have been an attempt by hardliners, who are still strong here, to try and derail the talks process. That's not quite clear yet. Or it may just simply have been, as Iran said it was, a response to similar but less publicized exercises by Israel.
Quickly, John, is the Iranian media playing this up at all as a kind of a victory, a sign of endorsement or credibility?
Not today, because it's a public holiday, but I think when the papers come out tomorrow, they will indeed say this is a big climb down by the United States, and to some extent it is.
John Lyne, thank you. John Lyne reports for the BBC World Service, and he came to us from Tehran, Iran.
And we're talking about Iran. You know, it's a very interesting, John described it as a come down by the Bush administration. So it is a concession, but talking with the Iranians at all is a concession based on U.S. policy.
Sounds a lot like what Barack Obama has said right. That he would do if he became
exactly.
President.
The world is shifting under these candidates, that's for sure. We've been talking about whether Fed Chair Ben Bernanke has too much power, speaking of world shifting underfoot. We're talking about a prisoner swap between Israel and Hezbollah. That's a big news story this morning. And we're also talking about movie sequels. Do you have a favorite? Do you have a dog, that one that shouldn't have been made?
You want to hear your story at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE. And we're talking sequels today, as John just mentioned. What is your favorite or least favorite? Should Good Enough be left alone? Our friend Dana says, sometimes.
Good morning. First sequel to Jurassic Park, The Lost World, dog. Sequel 2 to Jurassic Park, wonderful, a gem. This is Dana Franchitto in South Wellfleet, Mass.
Dana, thank you very much. Dana's actually our expert from Wellfleet, Mass. There on movies and all sorts of things. Sometimes the first sequel stinks, but the second sequel, the threequel, gets raves.
And, you know, let's not forget our Veep Stakes. Hundreds are playing our Veep Stakes. That is where you can vote on who should become the vice president for Barack Obama and John McCain, and it's a stock trading game on Facebook. If you want to take a look, check it out, www.thetakeaway.org.
And here's the takeaway from this hour.
You can get as drunk as you want at any party and do as many things as you want. Just make sure that nobody has a camera.
Make sure. Is there a camera? I'm surrounded by cameras. That was Eric Kuhn, new media consultant at Hamilton College, senior majoring in government, telling us how to run for president.
If you missed anything today, you can catch us on iTunes and Friend Feed.
It's a takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.